Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, August 14th, 2010. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic we pre-advertise for today is NWAPA, nuclear power. We need a breakout in technology, a breakout in identity. And I'm going to begin with the third breakout, a breakout from the grip of the London financial empire, in which you can see right now we are experiencing a crash of the ages, not merely a decline, but an all-out plunge into chaos. We'll get back to that and to our main topic after. I'd like to welcome people I have from the Midwest speaking to us from Chicago, from the LaRouche Political Action Committee team that's out at an air and water show today. I think that's right, but I welcome Ivan Korpis. Hi, Ivan.
Hi, Mark. Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you.
And is that right? You're at an exhibit or a rally or what?
This is the biggest spectator event in the United States. It's the Air and Water Show. It takes place over Lake Michigan.
Oh.
You may hear jets flying by overhead in the background.
We did just hear one, and I have heard about this. You're quite right. It's very impressive. Thank you for making this arrangement. And with us, Ivan and myself, we have here in the studio live Tanu Maitra. Welcome, Tanu.
Great to be here, Marcia. Thanks.
And you know Tanu goes back and forth between here and India, and he does many things besides the fact, I think, your engineering expertise from decades is nuclear engineering to begin with, right?
Yep.
But we also welcome him for his special involvement in the strategic situation today, which is I've already referred to as a plunge into the abyss. Let me use an expression Lyndon LaRouche used. He called it galloping awfulness in a new paper that will be posted very soon on his political action committee, I'm sure, LaRouchePAC.com. And LaRouche has titled this paper that's just being edited now, Learn from NWAPA, Mind or Body. I'll let you ponder the meaning of that. And we will have it on the LaRouchePub.com, that is Executive Intelligence Review Online, in a very short time, too. Now, this galloping awfulness, what I mean is, over the last week, among the many strategic events of the world, the Federal Reserve of the United States, this won't surprise anyone, but they really just said, yes, go full blast, open all the spigots, bail out everything, bail out all our pals, have derivatives like crazy. They call it, they use special jargon and they call it things like quantitative easing. You have the same thing going on with the euro in Europe. And, you know, we could speak specifics. I don't think that's, we don't need to take the time here. Food commodities, hyperinflation is going wild and it's just begun. Not begun, but it's just, don't look for it to stop. One example is junk bonds. Remember, we've had an episode of that in the 90s that came to a certain kind of infamy and conclusion. It never quit or went away. But you know, just this past week, you had more issuance of junk bonds in the United States than one week ever in history for junk bonds. And it was something like $15 billion in one week, the highest in the last 10 years for a week in August with $6 billion. And already the month of August is $21 billion, which is the highest ever. And August has two more weeks to go. This is straight out right bet with no pretense of any physical activity, physical commodity, or anything attached to it. So, all right. We're either looking at doom and obliteration, or we have the significance of the strategic interventions that we're organizing for in the United States on an immediate timetable. That is, we should get this guy who's sitting in the White House out, create the conditions he has to leave, Barack Obama, force the ending of speculation and what we've just described, the derivatives, the money flow, which is just blood money based on nothing except killing people. We need this Glass-Steagall reinstated, the policy we had in 1933 that worked for 70 years, which we had imposed under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Lyndon LaRouche several weeks ago said, launch the projects, build the biosphere, and specifically put on the agenda the North American Water and Power Alliance, NAWAPA, NAWAPA, which has a specific history. It was first proposed, well, its idea was proposed in the 1950s, but in 1964, a California-based construction consulting company, it may have been the biggest in the world at the time, the Ralph M. Parsons Company in Los Angeles, they proposed this plan to divert water southward on the continent of North America, takes a flow that would be going into the Arctic or the Bering Sea, and through the Yukon Rivers, the tributaries of the Mackenzie, and have it flow through western British Columbia down into western United States, and even some of it would arrive in northern Mexico. And it was heard in the United States that year in 1964 in the Senate with great support. And in fact, the special special committee that was created under Senator Frank Moss from Utah, their plan was get the Army Corps of Engineers assigned to it so that they could do the specific kind of workup required, the surveying, like they did in the Second World War when they did a crash survey for the Alcan Highway. And they built it on a crash basis. So they could do this, even if it wasn't built on a crash basis. You could have deployed the Army Corps to do the pre-work you needed. Well, none of this was done, but now this isn't just LaRouche saying, let's go back and pick up something the way it was. Many things have happened since then. And really, initiating this now is initiating a whole new strategic and scientific intervention into the condition of the planet. I'll give you a quote on that later, but our guests can address what all this means. And I point to a couple of things just in passing that the team, the research and development team, let's call it that, but the basement team, the science team that's been working on NAWAPA and its implications, NAWAPA at large, there's a couple of things posted that I recommend everybody see. One, I think it's called The Mind of Einstein on LaRouchePack.com for how the way in which we're looking at the world instead of some empiricist kind of, you can see for yourself. And there is also another one on the opposite kind of sense. I think there's one on the nature of Barack Obama, the failed personality. But so with that, let me turn to the Great Lakes, where Ivan has been in Detroit last week. Well, I know you go all over the place there. Right. But you've been involved in people one-on-one and in meetings and in interventions, raising the issue of the crisis nature we're in and how everybody has to act, which isn't maybe so normal for American citizens right now. Would you talk about it, Ivan?
Yeah, I can talk about that. I mean, the most important thing to impress upon people, especially those who have been confronted with reality to some degree, either through the economic collapse being felt directly or just, you know, being part of the thinking strata of the population, the most important thing to impress is that Lyndon LaRouche is providing the kind of quality of leadership that you would expect from a president of the United States right now in this crisis. And it's, I mean, we have to really fight with people to recognize that paradox and to investigate it so that they too can, you know, reap the benefits of trying to think through these conceptions that Mr. LaRouche is generating on a regular basis and the kind of leadership he's providing in the weekly report and in these papers that he's writing. I'll give you an example of what I mean. That what you're finding is that, you know, we had a town hall meeting in the Downriver area south of Detroit, and this is a place where, sure, you have all the auto industry assembly factories and stamping facilities and research and development facilities, but this downriver region is where you had some of the smaller machine tool design shops and, where you had the smaller, more closely held people who were, to a certain degree represented even more expertise in their field. And these people have been obliterated over the past 20 years by, NAFTA and then the Bush administration, the loss of manufacturing jobs, complete collapse since Obama took office. And they're FDR Democrats. They have, they show real voluntarism. They'll show real initiative in terms of signing up, giving their last $25 to become a LaRouche-backed member and helping us organize. So we had a town hall meeting there, and we found, these people are ready for the solution. But the only thing that would stand in the way is lacking a kind of cultural sense of the Promethean principle, kind of revolutionary spirit that the United States was founded on. Because for so long, for 40 years, through all these operations of the Congress for Cultural Freedom, the dumbing down of the population, it's not, if it is in them, they don't know where to find it. They can't locate it themselves. And this is why, the kind of leadership that we're providing and organizing, keying off of the role being played by Mr. LaRouche is so important, because he knows exactly where to locate it, that it's in the creativity of the human mind, not in sense perception. It's in the creativity of the soul. And, these kinds of poetic conceptions that you see Mr. LaRouche continually bringing forth, like redefining some of the basic concepts that people have assumed the definition of so long, like infrastructure, something like economy, creativity, always, continually redefining and finding new layers of meaning for these terms is the kind of role that, presidents like Abraham Lincoln played when he was commander-in-chief of the Union forces in the Civil War, or President Franklin Roosevelt in his fireside chat when he led the nation out of the Great Depression and through a crisis of civilization in World War II. And, we've got to be very serious with people that, there is leadership out there. There is somebody who's on the job, and that's LaRouche. And that's where you've got to go. You've got to join us. We are the solution. There's nobody else out there.
I have a question, Ivan. When you talk about this NAWAPA to the population today, the people that you meet, do you get a feeling that they are aware that this particular massive infrastructure project was conceived, and at that time it was thought that it can be implemented in 1960s, or they are completely unaware of it? And if and besides that, the second part of the question is, What do they think? What kind of questions they ask? Is the difficulty or technological problems or financial problems that this project cannot be done, or the project has to be done and they are ready to push their legislative bodies, whoever they are, to...
Funny, because the population, they have both psychological and financial problems. And they think it's the financial problems that are causing the psychological problems, but it's actually the reverse.
But do they endorse that this effort should be made to get this project going?
Yeah, absolutely. You really don't meet a lot of cynicism when mm-hmm. you introduce the concept of NAWAPA to people. And we've noticed that where you would expect that people would, they would sort of, kind of groan and say, oh, but it's going to cost too much. They don't. They don't ask how much it's going to cost. And it's probably because it's such an astronomical amount of money that they know that there's really no use putting an estimate on it. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost what it's going to cost, But, there's two different layers. I mean, there's two ways to answer your question, because obviously we've, as the LaRouche Youth Movement led by the basement research team has been doing outreach to engineers, to the Army Corps of Engineers, region by region of the country, to, you know, mining firms and to, you know, university professors who would be involved in, you know, actually building the WAPA and organizing to organizing the government to have it built. And so they have, you know, they have more familiarity with the project. They have a different set of concerns. And then there's the population at large, which has a different set of concerns. And, I mean, I can speak more for the population in general, because, you know, they don't really know NWAPA. They don't know what the acronym stands for right away. But the kind of questions that they ask reflect a serious, you know, a serious level of thinking that you don't necessarily see when you only talk to people about the problems. You can get somebody involved in thinking about what this would require, and, you know, that a project like this, or it's the same thing when you talk to somebody about the idea of Mars colonization, because they might bring up something which would be problematic, such as, you know, but there's no oxygen, you know, there's nothing to breathe there, or, you know, what are we going to do once we get there? Things that for them are legitimate problems. Maybe they haven't thought through the implications of it, but it's a sign that they are thinking. And so these, you know, just some last night, for instance, we were in kind of a, you know, kind of a youthful area of Chicago, and the kind of questions that the youth asked were, well, what is this going to do for the environment? And then you convey this idea that, well, it's going to totally transform the noosphere, and it's going to improve the productivity of the biosphere. But you do it in terms that they can understand. Mm-hmm. Say, this is going to allow these natural resources to serve mankind in a better way. We're going to harness these resources, and we're going to improve the quality of life throughout our national turf. And they can understand that. And then, you know, this young lady asked an interesting question. Well, how would this really change the weather in that area? And you can talk mm-hmm. to them at that point about, you know, the way that this would divert water, not anecdotally, but, you know, to permanently change these cycles and reorder the biosphere. So, I mean, I think it's one of these things where you're seeing a renaissance within the population, but, and it's kind of, if you stand back and look at it, it's happening very fast. But of course, when you're right up and you're trying to organize people, knowing that, you know, with everything that Marcia said, this thing is, you know, we're living in a period of galloping awfulness, doesn't seem to be happening as fast as it needs to.
Ivan, I will just give you a little sort of a thing to present to the people. In India, there is a desert called Rajasthan Desert. Actually, it is called Thar Desert, but it runs through a place called Rajasthan, where the state gets a rainfall average is 4 inches, and so it's basically completely. If you go there, it's all sand. There's nothing much there. In the middle of the sand, there are, you know, towns and things like that. But if you go to the western part of Rajasthan, which is bordering the Pakistan side of the desert, which is Sindh, a canal was, there was available water from the Indus, it was Mrs. Gandhi's concept to bring a canal all the way down to the southern end of Rajasthan, to the western part of Rajasthan. Now, this is just a canal. It's 120 feet wide, and it's lined, and it goes through nowhere. Now, that was eventually, it took a long time to do it because of the financial problems and all that. And it was not very clear at that point in time that what this particular canal is going to accomplish, because it is not going to an agricultural field or anything like that. However, there's some, you know, the people who always look at these things negatively said that this is basically a design by Mrs. Gandhi to prevent the Pakistani tanks to come into India, and this is sort of a barrier to the tank warfare and all that kind of stuff. Nonetheless, Rajasthan at that point in time was 100% what I should say, they never grew any cereal, so they're dependent on getting food from other states, which is fine, it's a part of the country. But if you go now, and this is now 1989, 1990, when it was completed. And then by now it is 2010, and long before 2010, I got the report around 2004, 2005, Rajasthan is exporting grain, if you can use the word export within the country, but sending out to other states grains because the weather change that it has caused by this canal in that area, which has allowed the all on either side of the canal, about a mile or a mile and a half on the western side and the eastern side of the canal, it has been completely green. And the canal water now can be utilized to, this canal water carries a lot of silt. And then the ground has been built up now, and they are growing, you know, enormous amount of wheat. And even they are getting a lot more rain in that area. And therefore, there are certain areas where even growing rice. So, you know, under 20 years, you know, this much of change has brought about. And when you're talking about, and when I talk about environment, we talk about, you know, hundreds and thousands of years. And probably in, you know, we'll not be around, but by 2100 or 2200, you know, this 1 mile area on either side of east and west will, you know, expand to 5 miles, 10 miles, and you'll eventually, you know, Rajasthan will be a perfectly good state for agricultural activities. Although, and the rainfall will increase. So this is I think the same thing we can describe about California Imperial Valley, and Marshall knows all about that.
Oh yeah, it's absolutely remarkable.
Yes. I had been to Rajasthan and I had been to that area, and there's nothing. And now it is all green. There are villages after villages, and there's lush sugarcane and all kinds of things. And it's almost seems mysterious how this thing came about.
Right. This is why we have to destroy environmentalists here in the United States. Because the fact is, whether it comes to, you know, nuclear and popularizing nuclear energy or these kinds of water projects, the environmentalists, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. Their science is, it's all faulty.
Yeah.
And so, really, got to not entertain the idea that there's any validity to this kind of, I mean, it's a really kind of a, you know, fascist, Gestapo-like mind control operation. It's the same kind that Obama's running, which people are so well aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's going to be the same kind of fight to, and this is why our website is absolutely, critical at this point, is because in order to adopt this kind of identity, which is necessary to defy popular opinion, to defy the Olympian gods, and call for Obama's impeachment, because believe me, this is where people have the biggest problem, is saying Obama mm-hmm. must be impeached. I don't care what it's going to take. We'll join you. No, we'll do everything to get this guy out. Because they lack the kind of inner strength, the kind of the development of the artistic imagination to say that we're acting on a historical scale to do the impossible. The only way that you can really develop this kind of strength of character in somebody is through the kind of program that LaRouche laid out for the LaRouche Youth Movement. It's going to have to be through reliving scientific discoveries for one's self and participating in the rehearsal and successful performance of classical art, because you have to develop a completely sovereign sense of identity and a real understanding of the action of universal principles, the kind of effect that they have on you subjectively, and the kind of the video product. Like, you'll see this video that Shauna and the Basement produced on the genius of Albert Einstein. Mm-hmm. People can receive at least an intimation of what the discovery of a principle is like by watching these videos. And we've got to, our job is to deliver that to the population. But that's leadership, to be able to provide that kind of direction. Without that, I mean, whether it comes to fighting the greenies, just crushing this environmentalist hoax, or destroying the last bit of Obama's political power, it's going to require a complete something that will come out of left field. I mean, in terms of the way that this nation and this culture has gone for the last 60 years since the time of Franklin Roosevelt.
And this is the perfect place, thank you, Ivan and Tanu, to plug something that's going to be coming up soon in the next perhaps 36 to 72 hours in the way of a feature video on NWAPA on the LaRouchePact.com. I understand you're going to have a chance to tour NWAPA from on high, perhaps mm-hmm. beginning up in the subarctic and flying southward. And zooming in if you wish, but otherwise seeing these installations, seeing the biosphere before underneath you, from some vantage point anyway. And again, this will, it's provocative, it's informative, but what you say, Ivan, it gives people, somehow or other, puts them in a different domain relative to the universe and puts your mind in coherence with creativity instead of this arbitrary. The environmentalist trick, right, for decades is we're going to stop in time. We have to preserve what's here as of 1947 August or some crazy thing like that. Mm-hmm. continue this if you like, but I do want to pick up on one thing for Tanu that, we think of the water conveyance nature of obviously, it's the North American Water and Power Alliance, and a lot of the power is hydropower, and why not? If you're going to be reorganizing water flows, you can get it's made to order to have hydro energy from it. And you just mentioned a wonderful water project in the subcontinent, the Rajasthan Canal. Mm-hmm. We can go into other continents another time. But on the nuclear side, this whole the original NWAPA proposal, where we're going way beyond it now, but it came out in the 60s when the view was, I think, when the United States should have 1,000 nuclear plants by year 2000. That was just a given.
Right.
As it is, we only have about 100. And by the way, Ivan's home territory there, Detroit Edison, was very active promoting nuclear power plants around the world. One of the gentlemen there, Walker Sisler is his name. He's since died, but he had a tabletop demonstrator model of a nuclear power plant, and he took it to Egypt. He took it to Iran. I think that's very apt. We can say something about what's happening. Russia's bringing in the rods, I think, this weekend for Iran's Bashir plant. But so Detroit, besides the whole, Illinois, I think Western Pennsylvania had the first commercial nuclear plant in the United States, but it was the Midwest. It was the Great Lakes Ohio Valley that was going to be one of the centers for proliferating civilian nuclear power.
Right.
So the LaRouche putting NWAPA on the agenda again isn't just moving around water and having hydropower, but Tanu, could you summarize this 30, 40-year period?
Yes, and it was interesting because after the U.S. came out of the World War II with enormous manufacturing capabilities, in fact, the World War II that U.S. Was so successful because of its building up of huge manufacturing capabilities. Then in the 1950s came the Atom for Peace program of President Eisenhower, And in our shipping port in Pennsylvania, that was the first nuclear power plant was inaugurated, and President Eisenhower inaugurated, talked about Atom for Peace as well. And if we look today, there are about 100 nuclear power plants exist. The highest we had here was 104. But if you between 1950, the shipping port went into action, I think, and became critical, I think, in 1959 and 1958, around that time. Now, but you just cannot build a nuclear power plant. In order to build a nuclear power plant, and nuclear power plant didn't exist before, you have to develop a whole bunch of technologies in order to develop nuclear power plants. For example, nuclear reactor is about 7 inch of steel, a special steel, which we never required before. So the entire material industry went through a complete revolution. The drop and forge industry went through a complete revolution. The nuclear, the radiation that comes into the steam made us develop a steam pipes, which are entirely different material than what we used before. Machining industry had to go through complete change. And all this, and all we did between, if we look at 1970, if we take 1970 or 1971, when the Bretton Woods was subverted, between this mid-1950s to 1970, this 15 or 16 years, we already have 70 to 75 nuclear power plants either in place or under construction. And but this is not the only thing that was going on. That was also going on was the space industry. You know, by 1969, we had the man moon. And again, you know, this 10 or 15 or 20 years in NOAA also came into existence. The NOAA concept came into existence in 64. So this enormous amount of energy and the manufacturing capability that the United States had after the war translated into development of these industries, which revolutionized the entire industrial process. And space, and also the nuclear. And space industry, of course, after 1970s, did certain things like shuttle and the space stations. So more industry, more technologies did come in the space industry itself. But the bulk of the technological revolution came in by 1970. Then we stopped. And these 30 years, the three decades from 1970 to 2000, we utilize this technology to make it to consumer goods, and we, a generation survived entirely on the basis of what this 15 years of work that was done, the technological changes that brought about by introducing this massive industries coming into place. Nuclear industry is not simply making power. Nuclear power is one part of it. But what nuclear industry does is that completely changes the technology of the industry itself. So industry goes through a degree of change. And this brings about, it enhances the capability, manufacturing capability, productivity, skill, you name it. Everything is involved in this. Same thing in the space industry. And this 30 years, we sort of didn't do anything. And converted these technologies into making more interesting gadgets for consumption.
You mean like a GPS, a GPS system so that you can get out of traffic.
That's right, all kinds of stuff. And then in 2000, really, by that time, the collapse had started, because already we started shipping out things to China in order to utilize the cheaper wage. That is the only way that we can survive, buying things, not on the basis of enhanced technology, but on the basis of low wage, which brings down the cost. And so it is this generation survived on the basis of what 15 years did. Now, if we now do the NOAPA, and of course, you know, eventually we have to go into fusion energy, and even in the nuclear industry, you can have very many technological changes, new generation of nuclear power plants. Now, this Marsha was talking about tabletop, you know, thing. Now, there is, there are serious discussions now going on about...
I meant a demonstrator, but you're talking about...
A serious discussion is going on, is that that you can... Now we are in a situation almost to build nuclear power plants, which will have, say, 100 years of lifetime. They could be 25 megawatt, they could be 100 megawatt, they could be as small or as big as possible. You never have to load it with fuel because, you know, thorium burns through, and thorium burns 100%, whereas uranium, the kind of arrangement that we have in the present generation of reactors is only 2% of the fuel gets burnt. Then we have to change the fuel. In thorium's case, it will be completely 100% will burn. So you just put the fuel in there, and the reactor will go on, and you don't have to change the fuel. You may have to change the cladding and things like that that covers the fuel rods, because radiation for a long period of time, we have not developed that kind of material as of now. But if we put our minds into it, we can also develop that. So a town can have a nuclear power, a cluster of 400 or 500 megawatt nuclear powers, and it will be consumed by the town. And you don't have to put it in a huge amount in the grid and ship it from here to there to everywhere. And in the process, you lose a lot of power. In the process, there's a 8 to 10% loss you incur when you take it to the grid. But you know, if we take this huge amount of money that is being now being put in to keep the derivatives of funds going, instead of that, we take that money and put into these kind of technologies, and over a period of 15 or 20 or a generation, 25 years, we'll be able to transform completely the whole thing, the whole technological base of this country. And this country's productivity will be so high that you cannot match it with cheap wage anywhere. And the reason that in the United States wage went up is simply because those 15 years of technological change that we did between mid-50s and by 1970, that allowed us to enhance our wage and the process, you know, better conditions of living. We go about that, we do that again for another 20, 25 years, and you will see that nobody will be shipping work out to China or India or anywhere else, simply because your productivity will rise so much, and the quality of materials and technical stuff that you're developing in this period cannot be matched by any other country. And that was the reason why between 1970s and 1990s, no outsourcing was even thought of.
Well, Ivan, you're in the area where you're speaking to second generation, if not first generation. You must run into people and heritage that has a sense of that. So it gets back to your question of, do people have the cultural courage to act, right?
Yeah, it does. It does always come down to that question. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live in such a paradoxical society because, it's true that all the technology exists. We still have the best universities in the world with the most modern facilities. People get hands-on training with, you know, the cutting technology that's driving the world forward. But at the same time, politically, culturally, they're completely Neanderthal. And so I give you an example. I went this summer, this spring, to a conference of the collegiate chapters of the American Nuclear Society. Mm-hmm. I can at least speak for, you know, the college age generation. Mm-hmm. That's coming up now. And, you know, their mentors, their professors, and the administrators of this American Nuclear Society, many of whom know the LaRouche movement from the days of the Fusion Energy Foundation, and they've mm-hmm. been subscribers to 21st Century Science and Tech. So, you know, it's kind of our people on that level. And this conference was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the university there. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because you would expect that they would speak the way that Tanu did, you know, just lay out what the future would look like, were we to have, just a respectable amount of investment into, the nuclear industry and related industries, instead of what's happened, which is, the whole thing's just been blackballed completely, and there's kind of a bit of denial to look at this as actual sabotage of the United States, destruction of our industrial capacity. But they don't speak that way, and instead, they're apologists. They're apologists for the nuclear industry, and they're always on the defensive and explaining why we have to develop solar and wind in combination with nuclear, because we've got to explore all the options. And nuclear power is not that bad. I mean, sure, it's really the only way we can provide baseload power for the United States economy now, but the amount of fuel that's produced is, or the amount of waste produced is really rather manageable. And it's all starting on the wrong footing.
Yeah.
And it's because of this division from a very early age in the training and education of these people, the schizophrenic division between classical arts and sciences, physical sciences. And until we can really unify these domains of knowledge and a greater degree of universality, you're going to continue to get these kinds of, I guess you could call it kind of a left brain, right brain problem. they left their brains in the laboratory or something.
Let me ask you, we still have 15 minutes, and I have an email I'll get to before the show's over from Mark in Chesapeake, Virginia. But you've been very active in different meetings or conferences. Is there any other one you want to mention before the time is over in the way of subjective response of different echelons of people?
Well, it's really fun doing the kind of organizing that we do, because from any given day you can be, in a very rural farming community, or you can be in downtown Chicago outside of City Hall, where you have all of Obama's cronies skulking around, or you can be at a conference of American Space Society or something like this. We had a chance to attend a conference like that in Chicago a few months ago, and this was a conference which was organized to basically promote, I think astronaut Rusty Ziegler was there. He was from the Apollo missions, and he gave a kind of a keynote presentation on this mission to find an asteroid that's within the sweet spot of those which might be potential, the kind of asteroids that we might potentially want to land on, or develop technologies to potentially deflect our orbit. It's John Holdren's idea of a B-movie science fiction movie plot.
Okay.
for NASA. Mm-hmm. And this was, and they were also promoting, there were a lot of, private entrepreneurs there who were there because, obviously, Obama, just like the healthcare bill, they want to give a lot of NASA's budget to private industry, to develop aircraft that would shuttle astronauts to and from the space station or what have you. And so there were some billionaires there. I was talking to one guy, and he said, I'm here because I'd like to buy the space shuttle once they retire it. but I guess they're going to run one more mission with that. But the point is that, and LaRouche made the point recently in a discussion with associates, is that really amongst the part of the population that decides what the policy is going to be now and for the future. They're intimately familiar with Mr. LaRouche and our ideas, and they see us as borrow from Schiller, kind of the ironies, or the kind of the sense of, yep, we should have listened to LaRouche 35 years ago. And so, the fact that we're getting younger is something which surprises them, always recruiting young people to these ideas. But, I mean, the fact that these guys are, they're willing to work with us, and we're finding this on the Nuwapa project too. They're willing to work without pay to help us get these things done. It's absolutely clear to these people, because they're thinking, they're in the real world, that this is an existential crisis for the United States, and it's happening in no other time frame than that which LaRouche has identified. I mean, we're talking about months at the latest.
Right, and I'll reiterate what you said at the outset about many of the basement team, others at large, people who are contacting members of institutions, some of the laboratories, geology, engineering locations, and so forth. And there's a tremendous mustering. There's an enlistment. There's a kind of self-recruitment, at least to move. This isn't decisive, but this process. And then you have the population at large. That you don't have to make that distinction. And in upcoming programs here, we have people who are prepared to be on different aspects that they happen to are their specialties, that they know something about. So, but, of course, we've got to get Obama out of the way. Let me ask you one thing, Ivan. This week also saw a big fight put up, a wonderful fight, against the Obama White House and this London control apparatus by Charlie Rangel in New York City, who chose to go against Nancy Pelosi and everyone else and speak out on the floor of the House in his defense about this rotten apparatus going against him, about these baseless charges. Then a couple, and he had a couple more events after that in New York City. And Maxine Waters, California, did likewise, where at the end of the week, she held a special hour-and-a-half press briefing and broke all the protocol rules and said, this is wrong, and said it in detail. Now, we're not going into that right here, but is it too early, or do you see that adding fuel to the flames of those now seeing they were wrong about Obama and the general population, Ivan?
Well, if somebody asks for whom the bell tolls, you can tell it tolls for Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are numerous signs at this point that the Obama administration is literally imploding. I mean, it's literally a house on fire that's falling apart. And there's the fire departments in the area have all been shut down under his policy. So there's nobody there to put out the fires for Obama.
Yeah.
In Chicago, it's interesting because there is really just a kind of the way that Obama's campaign was run here in Chicago makes it so that you would rarely, very rarely, see people step out of line to be critical of Obama. Especially it's a population where you have a preponderance of buppies, black urban professionals.
Right.
I would have to say, with all due respect, to white suburban kids, this is the part of the population that's least likely to break with popular opinion and to flout Obama. So you're not going to get that. What you are getting is people who come up to you on the streets of Chicago and say, I'll do anything to help you, but I've got to get out of here quick. They're taking my house. I lost my job. And not people who've been unemployed for a long time, people who've lost their job in the past year, past 6 months, and saying, look, I know this. We've got to do something. We've got to get this guy out. They can't foresee Obama lifting, one princely finger to help them. And so that's the kind of response we're getting. It's this sort of, it's almost like an underground kind of movement. Like, for the most part, you've got people who are trying to conduct themselves as if Rome we're not burning. But at the same point, at the same time, you have people who just, they can no longer sustain this delusion. It's come down to a human level for them. You know, that's where politics starts, you know, in terms of the highs and the lows. And so, yeah, we've got to organize the people, recruit them. We've also been to some town hall meetings, and there you find, you know, what's concentrated. We went to a town hall meeting of a congressman named Lipinski, Dan Lipinski, who's not the worst guy in the world. I mean, he voted against TARP. He voted against the health care bill. He just recently was the lead sponsor of the National Manufacturers Act or something like that to stimulate manufacturing. Because this area around Chicago was, a center of those kinds of industries. And the population at these meetings was these kinds of, you'd recognize at least as JFK Democrats, if not FDR Democrats. And there you just find people who are respond really well to Glass-Steagall. Yeah, we should have gone with Glass-Steagall. You know, what happened with that? Why did it fall off the table? And same thing with NWAPA. They say, yeah, this is exactly what we need. And they don't identify. They identify as Democrats, but, you know, having Obama as a president is not for them it's not a bragging right. It's nothing that they're proud of. They don't identify with Barney Franks and Nancy Pelosi's of the world any more than they did with the Bush and Cheney's. So we've got a natural constituency out there, and it was really kind of heartening to know that they're congregating at these town hall meetings when they're happening. And, you know, this is the organic leadership that LaRouche has referred to so often. They do exist, and they have to be mobilized around these solutions.
Right. Well, let me take this. It's not exactly on this. It might be a different tack, but it's in the same direction. It's because of your discussion earlier, Ivan and Tanu, that Mark sends the email back on the physical side of things about bringing water to desert soils. Of course, he says, how will you be able to break down the desert terrain to produce usable soil? And you know, much of what's called the Great American Desert in the West includes the part of the High Plains when you've had a whole series of bad years. But you have the Great Basin in Utah and Nevada. You do have some real desert, Arizona and New Mexico. And but remember, there's sand and sand. We can get back to this. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say something about this, Tanu, in terms of northwestern India or not?
Well, I think that whenever the deserts get transformed into agricultural land, there is no question that the water plays a very important role. Water brings in enormous amount of silt. And this, the sand also contains a lot of nutrients. Because of the lack of water, these nutrients cannot be activated and can be put together. So you bring in water from river, which contains a high amount of silt, and you spread it on the sand. And over a period of time, you see that even this silty, sandy land is producing, all kinds of agricultural producers. There is no problem in doing that. That's what California Imperial Valley did. They didn't take the sand away and put it transferred, brought in silt. It was just you spread the water around, and then the change the weather over a period of time, more rain comes in, and then within the silt, within the sand, there are a lot of active nutrients which come to play along with the silt, along with the water, and allows very many agricultural producers to come out.
Right, and of course, one of the textbook classic examples in world history is that of some of the desert areas of Egypt.
Yep.
Being in West Egypt or East Egypt, there are different oases and other projects.
Right. And in West Egypt, exactly the same kind of thing. Egypt has done quite a bit of, they don't have water. That's one of the major problems. But wherever they spread water around, they have found that the land, which looked completely barren and arid and non-fertile, has started producing. You have to add nutrients to it, and which every land you need nutrients, so that's nothing new. But water brings an enormous amount of nutrients along with its, you know, moisture and all the other things. So the silt that comes in with the water, every river water, is it does the work of fertilizer, and it creates bonds with the other nutrients that existed in the silt, but dry in dried condition.
Well, in the remaining minutes, we still have five more or less. This is the opportunity, Ivan, if we haven't covered something. Although I wanted to ask you about the anything upcoming. You just had this gathering, downriver, in the Detroit area. But are you going to continue, given the urgency, as you emphasized, about we have to have the conditions so Obama's forced out of office? Are you continuing in any special way? One thing is that I wanted to ask you before the time is over about work among these counties, localities, townships on Glass-Steagall. As you said, one person or some people you run into said, what happened to this at this town hall meeting? Why didn't we do it? Are you concentrating on anything special in that regard?
There's some towns that we have concentrated on, towns that helped pass the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. We're going to be sponsors of this Glass-Steagall resolution. Specifically, Flint, Michigan is one, which we've recently reported on. This just the epidemic of mass murder which is going on in Flint. And these people, they think so highly of us. They say, when are you coming back? When are you coming back to our town hall or to our city council meeting? They're so happy to see us. And in these downriver communities, we've gotten the same thing. We've literally addressed these council meetings, not necessarily to talk to the city council members, some of whom are blocked, but to appear on cable television stations. And some of these people, they came to our town hall meeting just from having heard us on speak at the city council meeting over the television.
Oh.
So you have. It's really astounding. We're in the darkest days of the Republic, and there are people who are not about to take this lying down. So, I think it's important just to keep the pressure on these politicians, especially as they're faced with the continual collapse of the towns and cities for which they're responsible. And these guys, they don't have a get out of jail free card. This mass strike is going to take their scalps too. They seem to be mismanaging the town. So, we can do the kind of organizing that we do, but the most important thing is to, find the people who are serious with us to whatever degree and raise them to a higher level. Get them to contribute everything they can in this time period, every hour of the day that they can offer, and every bit of cash to, help us move this thing forward.
That's great, and I'll underscore that. People can go on the LaRouchePAC.com website, and all the organizing materials are there. Mm-hmm. The petition for Glass-Steagall, it isn't a formal thing. Why not? You can take something and do it just as you're describing. And as you know, you should be sure and subscribe to EIR online. Get several subscriptions. Don't. And in particular, our latest one, number 31, which is NAWAPA, from the standpoint of biospheric development. You can also see LaRouche and the LaRouche Political Action Committee basement team statement on that in this issue. And, Tanu, I think our seconds are running out, but you must be very pleased after the fighting of the fighting for Indian independence from the British Empire, now the opportunity to defeat once and for all their form of environmentalist, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the Indian Independence Day is tomorrow.
Okay.
Oh, all right.
Today is Pakistan's Independence Day, 14th of August. And yes, I think that there is finally they have making certain moves in the right direction in identifying that nuclear power is going to be the only solution to India's, you know, starvation.
We are going to transform the biosphere.
Yes.
Well, we have run out of time, and I thank you very much, Ramtanu Maitra, and I thank you, Ivan Korpis. This is the end of the LaRouche Show for August 14th, 2010. Do come back again August 21st from 3 to 4 Eastern Time every Saturday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Goodbye.